Toronto. But next we're going to go to our monthly reports via Black Feminism Live. And it is a talk that Kim Crosby did at the second annual Gloria and Anzuelda luncheon at the University of Texas in Austin. So we're going to go to write that. Right, we're going to go to that, and we'll be back with Amanda at the top of the hour.
Hello, loved ones. Thank you to the organizers, to all the people who have made it possible for me to be here. I do not and never have done this alone, and I reject the celebrityism and individualism that often comes with this work. There are people who came before, are here now, and who will come after, who we may never acknowledge, and they are just as valuable to the movement as the people who are here with us today. This includes the people who clean this building, people who feed us, the workers who built it, the people who are made invisible systematically despite their vast contributions to the comfort that we live in. Every single person I've encountered in my journey here in a service capacity, driving cabs, cleaning, taking out garbage, have all been people of color, visibly gender nonconforming bodies, and predominantly women. I want to take the time to name them as their knowledge and labor informs and allows me to do all that I do. It is important to acknowledge the complexity of continuing to reify hierarchies by citing the same folks as political and social revolutionaries. That said, I want to acknowledge Lanzo and Celia, who both worked through ideas of liberation with me while working 15-hour days performing back-breaking labor. And I want to name that many of the people I will cite here today are not published authors, not people who have had the privilege of attending Ivy League institutions, are not able-bodied, are not light-skinned or cisgendered, nor are they based in the global north. These folks living at these intersections or multiple sites of oppression are the heroes and the shapeshifters, the folks who are negotiating how to arrange bail for their fam, the folks who are non-status. These are the people who cannot even travel across the border safely, much less get compensated for their work. We need this knowledge of liberation, and as the Egyptian feminist Nawal El-Sadawi so aptly expresses, we cannot acquire this knowledge through books, through Euro-Western formal education or the mass media. All of them are controlled by the global powers of domination and exploitation, and they help to veil our brains with one myth after another. We have to acquire this knowledge by ourselves from our own experience in the daily struggle against those powers globally, locally, and in the family. This is creativity. It is inspired and stimulated by our living our own lives and not by copying theories of struggle from books. Every struggle has its own unique theory inseparable from action. Creativity means uniqueness, innovation, discovering a new way of thinking and acting, of creating a system based on more and more justice, freedom, love, and compassion. If you are creative, you must be dissident. You discover what others have not yet discovered. And it is important to say that reading of each other's stories and experiences are also vital. They inspire and comfort us. But we must recognize that movement building is not about leaders. It is about decentralizing power, ensuring everyone has a right to self-determination, not simply placing the most eloquent, extroverted, expressive people at the top. My revolution knows that we need many medicines, that all bodies are valuable and that no one is disposable, and that anything new is also old. New is always fed by what has come before, and old is not the antithesis to innovation. We also must recognize that everything that happened in Nazi Germany was legal. Slavery was legal. In a system of capitalism where profit is the central goal and where corporations are considered people, we have to recognize that government will always need to protect their primary stakeholders, namely those who give the most money. Electing officials that are good people does not change a system that rewards the hoarding of resources at any expense. And this is not an effective way of protecting the interests of all people, particularly those denied access to resources. Transformation, accountability, always come from the people. These acts of genocide did not change because slowly over time, those responsible realized that it was wrong to brutally murder and enslave people. Liberation movements were led and ignited by oppressed peoples. And colonization is a process, just like liberation. We have never surrendered. We have never lost. I also want to acknowledge that we are on First Nations land, land that has been acquired through violence, genocide, and broken treaties. In this place now called Texas, this land was held by the Caddos, Carrancouas, the Comanche, the Apache, and the Tonkawa. A As someone who lives in Canada, another part of what still continues to be known as Turtle Island, I want to acknowledge that the land I live and work on is that of the Haudenosaunee and the Mississauga of New Credit. It is important to consider what your work in solidarity with First Nations communities are as settlers on this land. Where I live, First Nations organizing is currently focused around a movement, I Don't Know More, which is working for sovereignty as well as protection of lands and resources in the wave of recent bills accelerating cultural and environmental destruction. And while you are not responsible for the crimes of your ancestors, you are responsible for what you do about them now and their legacy. I also want to acknowledge the labor of enslaved people that constructed this country, including this campus. I want us to acknowledge migrant workers, domestic foreign workers, and folks filling up the prison industrial complex who divest themselves from their places of origin to invest in North America. We arrive challenging borders, fleeing imperialism of the global north, policies of the International Monetary Fund, and practices of free trade. We flee war and peacekeeping and environmental displacement. We all have a responsibility to consider how to make this world one that we all want to live in, are all entitled to live in with an abundance of respect, safety, and love. However, as bodies with complex and layered identities, our responsibilities are profoundly different. We each exist simultaneously in possession of privilege and of experiences of oppression. And while I have no desire to play oppression Olympics, we must recognize that these are not in equal amounts. Our social identities, our occupation are not. Our social political locations, political context and protest, land and occupation are not optional when we engage in dialogues around accountability, building safe communities, and challenging systems of advantage. As a foundation, I want to be clear on a few terms. Objectivity, neutrality, despite what you may have been told, are figments of the colonizer's imagination. We are all subjective, colored richly by our experiences. We are also all prejudiced. We do have a choice on whether we act on that prejudice, but I can't stress how deeply important it is that you examine your prejudices and name your bias. Your lived experience and social location deeply affects your analysis of the world and all its inhabitants. Language and culture are relative experiences, and that is why I do not deal in definitions, I deal in meanings. I am sharing with you experiences that cannot be understood without recognizing their broader context, and without also recognizing that multiple, sometimes even seemingly contradictory truths exist at the same time. I am not attempting to erase anyone's accounts or reflections, but rather I'm adding a layer of truth that should complicate your understanding. Collectively, we can weave together the complexities of our experiences. It is possible to create a world where there is space enough for all of us, even if for the moment we can only do it in our imagination, as part of our collective consciousness. This, too, is profoundly necessary work of creative visualization and liberation. I will be talking about systems of advantage, their places of intersection and characteristics, as it is located in my personal experience. I will cite many examples, but I'm not comparing the experiences to each other. Civil rights movements are not the same as gay marriage movements, are not the same as disability justice. When we make these dangerous comparisons, we erase those at the points of intersection, as well as the nuances of these struggles. It can be difficult because of the scarcity models that dominate in the governance of our communities to acknowledge our privilege and our sites of oppression. Having privilege does not make you impervious to suffering, as Eddie Ndoku says. It just means that aspects of your body, identities, and social location are not rendered a disadvantage on an institutional level. It is hard and difficult, but that is because these are hard and difficult things to examine. And as Cherry Moraga says, if we are interested in building a movement that will not consistently be subverted by internal differences, then we must build from the inside out, not the other way around. Coming to terms with the suffering of others has never meant looking away from our own. And as much as our life-saving work is in response to the monoliths of sexism, homophobia, ableism, transphobia, we are left knowing more about our oppressors than our comrades. And I am most interested in the transformative work of learning of each other, from each other, unpacking our internalized experiences of oppression and addressing the many wounds that we have sustained from each other within our marginalized communities. And so what of us, those who stand at the intersections of race, class, gender, sexuality? I am fundamentally concerned with our strategies for resistance and self-care, our experiences of state-inflicted sanctioned violence, I am primarily concerned with the breaking open of spaces where our stories are recognized in such a way that they are able to create policy, education, and justice. I am a mixed-race woman. My mama is Venezuelan Arawak and Indian, and my father is Scottish West African and Dominican from Dominica. My father's father was a plantation owner, and he was referred to as Massa. I was born in Trinidad, raised in Toronto. I would often qualify the exact quantity and source of the many different ethnocultural communities that run through my blood. Anti-Black racism means that I'm often denied admission into Latina, South Asian, and First Nations communities. The internalized of white European representations of communities of color means that folks that look like Jennifer Lopez become emblematic representations of what it means to be Latina. A recent reflection from a Brooklyn-based femme of color, Yumi Thomas, brought me so much solace, and she writes, I am not half Japanese and half Lithuanian Jewish. When I am singing a Japanese folk song, I don't sing with half my voice, but with my whole voice. When I am taping together my grandparents' Jewish marriage contract, worn by time but still resilient, it is not half my heart that is moved, but my whole heart. I am complete, and I embody layers of identities that belong together. I am made of layers, not fractions. And I am able-bodied, English-speaking, female assigned at birth, an immigrant, but with Canadian citizenship that my mama fought for on my behalf. These are a few of the privileges that I enjoy. I did not earn them, and they have no intrinsic value despite the enormous value that they are assigned and the benefits I reap in this system. I have never been incarcerated, even though I participate in a system that does violent criminal things daily. I identify as a queer femme, as a short skirt wearing, heels rocking, push-up bra wearing girl. My granny left me a legacy of feminists that I am constantly examining. I am also light-skinned, and although I grew up a community of white folks who regularly dehumanize me through an enormous amount of racism, I have to recognize that so many Black female political canons are light-skinned. Angela Davis, Rosa Parks, Audre Lorde, Kathleen Cleaver, Toni Morrison, Dora Neale Hurston. And as Ashley Alexis McFarland, a community organizer in Toronto, shared, time for some sister talk. Until our darkest, Black not brown, roundest, not Rihanna fat, short and kinky, not curly haired, thickest nose and lips are really regarded as beautiful, are celebrated and canonized, and share equal opportunities, how far have we really come? We need to recognize that our freedom is wrapped up in each other, and despite the fact that we are taught that we can only get ahead at each other's expense, it is possible to change our minds, to confront our biases so that we can transform the way that we treat each other and ultimately ourselves. Each of you is already a unique and valuable person when you are born. Every single one of us is. We vary from minute distinctions to enormous diversity, from an incalculable mixing of environments and history that has never happened before and will never happen again. And whether you believe that we are children of a creator or made of the bellies of stars or something somewhere in the middle, either way, each one of us is divine and a little piece of the heavens. Octavia Butler says, everything you touch, you change, and everything you change, changes you. And the truth of the matter is that we are sensitive creatures, all of us. We are affected deeply by everything around us, from the overrepresentation of some of us in the media and the underrepresentation of others. We are affected by the ways we punch our boys, kiss our daughters, and deny our trans siblings. The fast food joints on every other corner in the hood and the organic markets that appear sometime later in those same neighborhoods as they are gentrifying. We are taught that there is a standard that we should all be adhering to, a standard of ability, of productivity, of education, or of development. And even worse so, we assume that one small group of people can define that standard. And what I want to share with you today is that we cannot impose our standards on each other. We need to create the conditions for self-determination for individuals and communities, for interdependence, not dominance, for systemic change and not charity. These are ways that we will change the world, rooted in a deep desire to learn of each other, from each other, through collaboration, justice, and love. Capitalism would have us believe that we only deserve to be here because of what we produce, and even in our communities, we often reproduce the same ableist ideas. Alexis Pauline Gums recants this story about Lucille Clifton as a small girl reciting a poem. as she stood unable to remember the poem in front of the church mothers, encouraging her and expecting her to perform, her mother stood up for her. She felt pressured, and she said, "I don't wanna." And her mother stood up in front of God and everybody and smiled at her child, and she said one small sentence that changes the meaning of life for Black girls growing up in patriarchy and capitalism. She don't have to do nothing she don't want to do. So many negatives adding up to the positive clarity that Black girls are inherently valuable, lovable, period. When had someone stood up and said that for us? When in a world of forced labor, coerced sex, billions of expectations? When had anyone even dared suggest that we were not valuable because of what we produced, what we created, who we entertained, or how well we pretended to be happy? When had we said it for ourselves? This is resilience. This is resistance and defiance. We know this place, and we are able to create it for each other. Whenever there is oppression, there is resistance, but endurance should not be confused with transformation. I want to invite all the folks in the room who are invested in the process of allyship to regard us with the agency that we deserve. Women make decisions from empowered places and disempowered places. And the solution to disempowerment is to eliminate barriers and create healthier conditions. It is never to make decisions on our behalf, to remove or reduce agency. It is never to save us. We ask that you listen, look around, and pay close attention. Women and girls spend their whole lives learning about men and masculinity, whether it is in movies, TV shows, video games, history, literature, science. And what I am proposing is a shift that extends beyond this day. A decision to learn about girls and women and femininity, to study the girls who are blacksmiths, bending fire and metal to make miracles in the kitchen. Girls who work hands hard in fields every day. Girls who are quiet and introverted. Girls who are explosive and dynamic. Girls who love pink and girls who hate it. This also means embracing the feminine and the power in things often regarded as women's work. It means embracing all of us. When it comes to our freedom, it is either none of us or all of us, and I, for one, am leaving no one behind. We have a need for many different medicines and not just one. And with the world as it is, many things need to change, and it won't be one voice, one solution, one plan. It will be all of us. We need each other, and our lives literally depend on it. A key to this is what David Orr says. The plain fact is that the planet does not need more successful people, but it does desperately need more peacekeepers, healers, restorers, storytellers, and lovers of every shape and form. It needs people who live well in their places. It needs people of moral courage willing to join the fight to make the world habitable and humane. And these needs have little to do with success as the way our culture has defined it. And we need something else that has become kind of a dirty word. We also need feminism. Feminism. Feminism is a movement to end sexism, sexist exploitation, and oppression. Feminism does not target men as its enemy. Rather, it is the structure of the society with which it is at odds. Feminism is for everyone because feminism is for freedom. But the lack of intersectionality and therefore solidarity in many feminisms is troubling at best and killing us at worst. And sometimes we are afraid to speak, afraid to sign, afraid to communicate, and afraid that there will be consequences, and often there will be. We are punished for fighting for our own liberation. But why live frightfully at the edge of subsistence? What use is a long life without the quality of freedom? Our silence, our compliance, only enables the system to keep going. It needs us to feed it. We, on the other hand, do not need the people at the top. The system was not made for us to be sustained, and when we do, we must remember that it comes at the expense of others. And so our silence will not save us. It will only separate us. We work for each other now and for generations to come, and sometimes our actions will not be felt by us, but will contribute to a future for those who come after. Recently published in the American Political Science Review, the largest study of its kind details violence against women conducted over 4 decades and in 70 countries. Its core finding was that the mobilization of feminist movements is more important for change than the wealth of nations, left-wing political parties, or the number of women politicians. The scope of the data for the study is unprecedented. The study includes every region of the world, varying degrees of democracy, rich and poor countries, and a variety of world religions. It encompasses 85% of the world population, and analyzing the data took 5 years, which is why the most recent year covered is 2005. These strong, autonomous, grassroots feminist movements were the first to articulate the issue of violence against women and the key catalyst for government action, with other organizations sidelining issues perceived as being only important to women. Strong movements commanded public support and attention and convinced the media the issues were important for public discussion. In countries that were slower to adopt policies on violence, feminist movements leveraged global and regional agreements to push for local policy change. What these findings tell us are that the single most powerful resource in transforming the state and safety of girls and women are the women and girls in their own cities, villages, and countries. And so, we must remember that it isn't just about us going to good schools and getting good jobs. It is about making the space for us when we are single mothers, on welfare, cleaning toilets, on the reservation, and in prison. And if and when some or all of us get these jobs and opportunities, we have to break down barriers for others. We have to open doors and pull out chairs and share resources and experiences. We are not the reason why it doesn't feel like there is enough to go around. But us in our numbers is the key to getting all that we need. We together represent a critical mass of girls unwilling to back down and finish being politely angry. I won't promise you it will be easy, but I can promise you that we can do this. We have everything that we need. We are powerful beyond measure, and although it will take generations and it will be hard, it will not happen without us and without all of us. And I want to leave this with the words of Mia Mingus, who is a transnational Korean disabled adoptee, and she says, "It is from being disabled that I have learned about the dangerous and privileged myth of independence and embraced the power of interdependence. The myth of independence being, of course, that somehow we can and should be able to do everything on our own without any help from anyone. And this requires such a high level of privilege, and even then it is still a myth. Whose oppression and exploitation must exist for your independence? Because the truth is, we need each other. We need each other. And every time we turn away from each other, we turn away from ourselves. We know this. Let us not go around, but instead, let us go courageously through."